Section, we're going to start at Deuteronomy chapter 10. Now, somebody asked me, are we really going to cover the remainder of Deuteronomy in three sessions? And it's a fair question. It's a question filled with astonishment. And the answer is even more astonishing. The answer is yes. Now, I say that by faith simply because it cannot be any other way. We only have three more sessions. Now, in some cases, we might be able, if we didn't finish on schedule, and there have been some books of the Bible, some previous years, that we have had the luxury of spilling over into the next week and simply taking it out of some other book. The problem is, I have a commitment this weekend and all next week to teach down in California, which means I have to leave Saturday, and I won't be here next Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday. I'll be coming back later in the week. So it is simply not an option for me to not finish this week and to pick it up next week. I won't be here. Also, this is one of the few books in our tape library that we do not have videos of. That's why we're videotaping it right now. We don't have any videos of Deuteronomy. So we can't even spill over till Monday with videos. We have to finish this week. Now, if it were another book, if it were a book of a different character than this, that would be more tragic than it actually turns out to be. It's clear that we have to survey some chapters. We have to breeze through some material without making elaborate comments on it. But since this is Deuteronomy, and since much of the material that we have to cover has been covered in previous portions, and especially in Exodus and Numbers, it is simply a matter of me disciplining myself not to say too many things about passages that have already been covered. In fact, what I must do, we must cover six or seven chapters in this session, and have similar coverage in the next two sessions to finish it. And we shall. We shall do that. But I'm just preparing you for the fact that we're going to come to sections that I'll simply say, now we covered the material in these verses back in Numbers or back in Exodus. We will have no further comments on them at this time. Let's go on to more. And that's how we're going to survey this. If we had unlimited time, I could take my leisure, as I've been doing more than I should have in the previous sections. Now, in chapters 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, which we've been covering most recently, we are talking in Moses' second discourse, and most of what he is giving them, although there are some instructions and commands to keep the law, of course, and to teach it to their children, and to love the Lord their God, yet the majority of what we're covering is a historical survey. Not necessarily in chronological order. He's gathering anecdotal material from their past, the 40 years of wandering. He's mentioning things in whatever order they occur to him to mention, rather than trying to give a chronological survey of the past. There's no need to do that. He's sermonizing. He's not historicizing. Now, what he's saying is historically true. I'm not trying to bail him out of some apparent historical inaccuracies or anything like that. He is telling historical true stories, but he's not doing it as a historian. He's doing it as a preacher. And therefore, in order to make certain points, he will gather historical bits from the past to establish his points. Most recently, in chapter 9, he spent that chapter describing documented cases of rebelliousness on the part of the Israelites. He begins that chapter by saying, don't think that God's given you the land of Canaan because you're better than other people, or because you're more righteous. As a matter of fact, if you start thinking that way, you're going to be way off the mark, and you're going to have a wrong relationship with me as well. You need to realize, humbly, that you are not better. It's just that these people are so wicked, God can't tolerate them anymore. It's not because you're exceptionally good that he's given you the land. And then he documents that with certain cases. He brings up, of course, the first and most important case of rebellion. Well, there was rebellion before this case. Of course, at Marah, the people grumbled. But when they came to Mount Sinai, the most terrible early rebellion in their career was when they made the golden calf. He talks about that. He talks briefly, just in mention it, about when they grumbled about the water and so forth later. And then he also talks about the so-called provocation in Numbers 14 when they refused to go into the land. But he does so just sort of parenthetically. He's kind of repeating the story of how he got the Ten Commandments, how they violated them, how he broke them, and then now he's in chapter 10 talking about going back up the mountain and making the second set of tablets. In chapter 10, He says, at that time, the Lord said to me, hew for yourself 2 tablets of stone like the first, and come up to me on the mountain and make yourself an ark of wood, or a box, a chest made of wood. And I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets which you broke, and you shall put them in the ark, or in that box. So I made an ark of acacia wood, hewed 2 tablets of stone like the first, and went up to the mountain, having the 2 tablets in my hand. And he wrote on the tablets, according to the first writing, the 10 commandments, which the Lord had spoken to you in the mountain from the midst of the fire in the day of the assembly, and the Lord gave them to me. Then I turned and came down from the mountain and put the tablets in the ark which I had made. And there they are, just as the Lord commanded me. 2 things to note about this segment. Whereas in the first case, God had made the tablets of stone and written the law upon them, since Moses broke the first ones, he had to come up with the next set of tablets. And so he created the new tablets, though God still wrote the law on them. Moses did not write the laws on them, but he had to replace the tablets that he had broken. The ark that he speaks of here, it's curious, because it does not appear to be a reference to the Ark of the Covenant. He does not, for instance, talk about the acacia wood being overlaid with gold, as we know the Ark of the Covenant was. He just says he made an acacia wood box to put the tablets in. And that would be no problem, except for the fact that he says at the end of that, and there they are. In other words, even at the moment he speaks 40 years later, they're still there in that box. Whereas, we are told elsewhere that the tablets were kept in the Ark of the Covenant. And the only way I know to harmonize this is to say either the box that he made was placed inside the Ark of the Covenant when it later was made. That is, he made a box provisionally to contain the tablets until the ark was made, and then the box and the tablets and all were put into the Ark of the Covenant, in which case the box he made was a little smaller than the Ark of the Covenant, or that the box he made became the basic box, which later was elaborated upon to make it into the Ark of the Covenant. Its legs and its poles and its rings and its overlaid with gold was a later embellishment of the original box. It's not very important, except for the fact that, you know, there is something there to harmonize. There is the fact that he says here that those stone tablets were still in this box that he had made, which he does not describe in terms that would seem to identify it as the Ark of the Covenant, yet we're told elsewhere that that's in fact where the tablets were. They were in the Ark of the Covenant. So either this box was placed into the Ark of the Covenant, tablets and all, or else this box was later added to and overlaid with gold, so it became the Ark of the Covenant. Verse 6 through 9, we have a parenthesis, which is one of those later editorial comments, something that was probably not part of his speech, but something that was added to it. It talks about where Aaron had died, and then talks about the other journeyings. And the reason I say it's an editorial comment is because it says in verse 8, at that time, the Lord separated the tribe of Levi to bear the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, to stand before the Lord, to minister to him, and to bless his name to this day. Then it says, therefore, Levi has no portion nor inheritance with his brethren. The Lord is his inheritance, just as the Lord your God promised him. It sounds like that line was written after the people had come into the land, and Levi was exceptional in not having land. The other tribes would have had land, would have had portions by the time this tape was made, but he's saying, just like God said, Levi didn't get one. And to this day suggests a time later than the generation of Moses, at least it would seem to. And since it's in parentheses, of course that's the translator's preference to put parentheses there, but the translators acknowledge, which I think most scholars would, that this is sort of an aside, like several others that we've seen back in chapter 2, which sort of updated information, kind of inserting between the lines of what Moses said certain information that would be of interest or of importance to update the reader. Verse 10, at the first time I stayed in the mountain 40 days and 40 nights, the Lord also heard me at that time, and the Lord chose not to destroy you. Then the Lord said to me, arise, begin your journey before the people, that they may go in to possess the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? This is a very good, important verse. It begins the same way that the verse in Micah 6:8 begins, which says, he has showed thee, O man, what is good. What does the Lord require of you? I would say that question is the most important question any human being could ever ask. If there is a God who made me, and if he is intelligent and purposeful, it must be that I've been designed and purposed for something. He must have some reason for making me. He must have some expectations, in other words, that I will fulfill some kind of a plan that he had in mind when he made me. What is it he's looking for? What are his expectations? What does he require of me? The answer to this is simply the answer to the great question of what is life all about? But also the question of how can I be right with God? Whatever God requires of me is what I must do to be right with God. Therefore, not only the meaning of life is included in the question, but the means of salvation. How can I be right with God? Which is, of course, what salvation involves, being right with God. To answer both those questions, which are both, of course, the most essential questions relevant to our created state, we need to know what is it God wants out of me. Now, it's interesting that here, when he asks the question, what the Lord your God requires of you, here's the answer. But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes which I command you today for your good. Now, you might notice, this only deals with what God expects of you with reference to your relationship to him. Jesus, as we know, when asked what the great commandment was, said there are two commandments. One has to do with our relationship with God. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, with all your strength, and so forth. But he said there's another command of equal or at least similar value, which has to do with your relationship with your fellow man. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. This statement, in asking what does God require of you, answers only the half of it. Well, at least focuses on the first half. What does God expect for you to do with reference to himself? Well, he wants you to fear him, love him, walk in his ways, serve him. But there is the hint of the other part in verse 13, and to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which have largely to do with your horizontal relationships. You shall not kill, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, and so forth. All our commands and statutes of God, all of which imply, in addition to loving God, in addition to a vertical relationship, there is horizontal relationship to be considered. And in Micah 6:8, it is that horizontal relationship that receives the focus of his statement when he says, he has shown thee, O man, what is good, what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice. But the King James says, do justly. To love mercy. And to walk humbly with your God. Now, walking humbly with your God may sound like it has to do with your vertical relationship, and in some respects it certainly does, though humility is something that's manifest mostly in the way you deal with other humans, whether you put yourself above them or them above you. It is because of walking with God, because of your awareness and concern for your relationship with God, that you remain humble. But that humility is something that is... that affects mostly how you view your fellow man. Do you put him above or below yourself? Doing justly and loving mercy, likewise, are social behavior norms. They are not religious. They're not devotional aspects. Like fearing God and loving God has more to do with your devotional, vertical relationship with God. But doing justice, loving mercy, has to do with the way you treat people. The way you relate to society. And so we are twice confronted with the question of what does God require? In Deuteronomy, the focus here is on what he requires with reference to your relationship to God, with some hint of the horizontal there in verse 13, which would be included in keeping the commandments of the Lord. It has something to do with your horizontal relationships too. But in Micah, the focus is on the horizontal, your relations with your fellow man, doing justice, loving mercy, and walking humbly. But there is also the hint of the vertical there, of course, walking humbly with your God. In other words, God's just not looking for you to be humble. Some humanists may adopt a humble attitude, because they're maybe sorely aware of their own limitations and weaknesses. They know it's silly and stupid to be prideful. Even non-Christians speak of foolish pride and realize that humility is a good thing. But God's not asking for justice, mercy, and humility because of humanistic reasons, and there might be humanistic reasons, love for your fellow man, that an atheist himself has. But he's looking for these characteristics to arise in the life that is humble before God, that is, has a life that is lived before God, consciously before God, and is just and merciful and humble toward his neighbor because he is walking with God. So we have in the two passages, one focuses more on the one and the other on the other aspect of what God requires, loving God and loving your neighbor, though both of them still make some passing reference or some hint as to the other side that is not in focus in them. In verse 12 here, it says, you shall fear the Lord your God and walk in his ways, and love him and serve the Lord. Now notice, fear and love have to do with, in a sense, what's in your heart toward God. Walking in his ways and serving him have to do with your behavior. There's sort of a parallelism here that we have come to recognize as normal in Hebrew poetry. He's saying essentially two things. Or he's saying one thing twice, another way to put it. He says, fear the Lord and walk in his ways. Speaks of having the right heart attitude and the right behavior. Then he says it again a different way. Love the Lord and serve him. Again, speaking of your heart attitude and the behavior that comes from it. If you fear the Lord, you will be afraid to walk out of his ways. The fear of God is not really an alienating kind of fear. And it's not even a fear that has torment, such as John talks about in 1 John chapter 4. You know, perfect love casts out that kind of fear that has torment. The fear of God is simply a healthy fear for the consequences that accrue to disobedience. My children and I have a very positive relationship, but I have hopefully instilled in them a fear of disobeying. A fear that is of the consequences of disobedience. And it is that fear of being wrongly related that keeps them rightly related. And as long as they are rightly related, they don't have to be afraid. It's kind of a paradox in a way. I'm not afraid of traffic. I'm not afraid of freeways. As long as I am going the same direction as the traffic, about the same speed, and rightly related to the flow of traffic, there's nothing to be afraid of. If I slammed on my brakes in the middle of freeway traffic, or tried to drive perpendicular to the flow of traffic, or against it, there'd be much to fear. And I would be afraid to do that. And it's just because I'm afraid to do that, that's the reason I don't do it. And because I don't do it, I don't have to be afraid of it. You know, it's like, the fear of the Lord is something that resides sort of in the foundation. It's the beginning of wisdom. It's sort of an underlying awareness that people who don't live according to God's standards are going to be in a heap of trouble. And fearing that trouble causes a person, as it says in Proverbs, the fear of the Lord causes a man to depart from evil. Once he has done so, that fear of the Lord remains there as an underlying thing that keeps him from going back to evil. He lives with a fear of what would happen if he turned from God. But because he chooses to obey God, he doesn't live in terror. The terror arises only at the prospect, the potential of living at odds with God. Again, I very rarely have emotions of fear or sensations of fear when I pull onto the freeway. But if I thought for a moment that my car was going to stop dead in its trail in fast lane, that thought would be a scary thought. And therefore, I'm determined not to slam on the brakes in the fast lane, unless the car in front of me does the same first, in which case I just have to commit my life into the hands of God and hope that the traffic behind me does the same thing. The point is, fear of God is simply the fear of being wrongly related with him. It is a healthy appreciation for what would happen if I were in wrong relationship with him. But as long as I remain in right relationship with him, which I am at liberty to do, I don't live in torment. You see, the only kind of fear that torments you is the kind that you have no control over. People are often tormented by the fear of nuclear war, or fear of getting cancer in their old age, or fear of being financially insolvent because of some unpredictable crisis that may occur in their future. fear of the crash of the economy, things that they can't control. You are not tormented by the fear of eating arsenic, although you would fear to eat arsenic. You don't have to do it. You have control over whether you do that or not. You would fear the consequences of eating arsenic, therefore you are afraid of arsenic. But you're not living in fear constantly because you have control over whether you put that stuff in you or not. Likewise, the fear of God is not the fear that, you know, any moment God's going to jump out of the bush and say, gotcha, and judge you, as if it's not within your control. Your relationship with God is very much your decision. And the person who has a healthy fear of the Lord chooses to be rightly related, in which case all the negative aspects and sensations of fear are no longer irrelevant. Except at those moments when I'm tempted or considering doing something I know would put me at odds with God, suddenly the fear of God is still present to kick in and say, wait a minute, don't want to do that. And it is the fear of God is sort of like the gyroscope that keeps you balanced on the tightrope, see? I mean, as long as you're on the tightrope, it doesn't matter how far the fall is, you don't have to be afraid if you've got your balance. But if you step to the right hand or the left, there's a great fall there and it's the end of you. And of course, what keeps you on that narrow road, what keeps you on that tightrope is the fear of God. It keeps you from stepping to the right hand or the left. It keeps you right on balance. Maybe tightrope's not a good illustration, because most of us would fall off a tightrope no matter how careful we're being. Let's just say a narrow wall that we have to walk along the top of, where we could, if careful, we don't have to fall off. But if careless, we would. And so the fear of God keeps us from being careless about obedience. And that's the fear we're supposed to have. And if we do have the fear of the Lord within us, he says the result would be to walk in his ways. It is the fear of what would happen if I walk out of his ways, if I step off that narrow road and fall to my doom. Excuse me. Again. And then to love him is another, you know, inward response, but it generates service. I serve him out of love. To love him and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. So what God's looking for is people who fear him and love him, and whose fear for him and love for him is so genuine that it calls forth the reasonable response. Staying on his paths and serving him with gladness. Verse 14, indeed heaven and the high heavens belong to the Lord your God, also the earth, the Lord your God, also the earth and all that is in it. Now, as far as who owns the earth, the Bible gives us mixed signals here. In Psalm 24, it says, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And that's true. I mean, obviously, even this says so, the earth is the Lord's. It also says in the Psalms, elsewhere, that even the heavens are the Lord's, but the earth has he given to the sons of men. Which seems like I would be able to give you a reference for that if I say it says it in there somewhere. I think I might be able to find it quickly. I think it's Psalm 115. Yes, Psalm 115, verse 16. Even the heavens are the Lord's, but the earth he has given to the children of men. Now there's a sense in which there's a difference between the heavens and the earth. Man has never been able to invade, nor has he been given any dominion over the heavens. Those are strictly in God's control. The earth, however, is in one sense God's and in one sense man's. It is God's, and therefore it is his to give to whom he wishes, and he has chosen to give it to man. But in giving it to man, God has reserved the right to still have his way, his sovereign will in the matter. He has given man some reign, some freedom over what takes place on the earth, but God is still overall transcendently in charge, like the captain of the ship. The passengers on the ship, he may give total free reign, or he may restrict them however he wishes, but he can say, okay, you passengers, you can do whatever you want on the ship. And he has given dominion of the ship to the passengers, with one exception. They can't come to the helm and steer the ship. They can do whatever they want. They can affect very, dramatically the conditions of life on the ship. But as far as where the ship's ultimately going, that's still in the hands of the captain. And God is, I understand it that way with history, he still really owns the ship, but he's turned over the running of it in day-to-day matters to man. He's given man the responsibility and the stewardship of the earth. But man does not have so much dominion that he could somehow wrench the earth entirely out of God's purposes and prevent God's purposes from taking place. In one sense, he has given the earth to the children of men. In another sense, it's quite obvious that it's still God's. He made it, and he's never really surrendered the entire title to it. Verse 15, the Lord delighted only in your fathers to love them. That is, as opposed to other Gentile nations. He delighted in them alone to show special favor to them. And he chose their descendants after them, you above all peoples, as it is this day. Therefore, circumcise the foreskin of your heart, and be stiff-necked no longer. Now, the circumcision of the heart is a doctrine that becomes more prominent in the New Testament, although it is mentioned at least in two books in the Old Testament. In Deuteronomy, it will come up again later, by the way. Not only here does he tell them to circumcise the foreskins of their heart, it's also mentioned later in Deuteronomy 30 and verse 6. But Jeremiah also urges the people to be circumcised in their heart. In Jeremiah chapter 4 and verse 4. So, while the New Testament indicates that the only circumcision that matters to God at all is the circumcision of the heart, which Paul states in Romans 2, verses 28 and 29, and also in Philippians 3:3. And he also mentions the circumcision of the heart in Colossians 3, Colossians 2, I think it's in verse 12 or so. Circumcision of the heart is mentioned there as well. In the Old Testament, circumcision of the flesh was still required, but the circumcision of the heart was even more important. These people were apparently circumcised physically, although come thinking, I think these ones may not have been. These ones may not have been, because Joshua indicates that they hadn't been, right? This was the generation that had not been. Their fathers had been, but their fathers had neglected to circumcise them. So, interestingly, rather than Moses saying, circumcise your foreskins, which they apparently needed to do too, and they did after they came into the land with Joshua, or right at the beginning there, Moses shows more concern, even though they stand there as uncircumcised Jews, that they get the circumcision of the heart straight first. Of course, that would result, once they're obedient to God, they would also circumcise themselves physically. It says, for the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality nor takes a bribe. Some people do try to bribe God by giving large gifts to the church or by doing religious things. God is not interested in bribes. He's interested in justice. A good judge will not take a bribe. And the difference between a just judge who won't and an evil judge who will is that a good judge is more concerned about justice than he is about being pacified. He's not so much interested in having someone do him a favor. He's interested in seeing the demands of justice uncompromised. And therefore, a just judge will not take a bribe. An unjust judge who puts his own self-interest above that of society in general will take bribes. God does not take bribes. Of course, he is concerned that people give him what he has coming to him, but he will not, because someone decides to do some special favors for him, neglect justice. He will not, for example, allow a criminal who deserves to die go free simply because that person does God some kind of special favor by performing some religious act or giving some kind of sacrificial gift or offering a sacrifice. But God won't be bribed. He administers justice for the fatherless and the widow, and loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Therefore love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall fear the Lord your God. You shall serve him. And to him you shall hold fast and take oaths in his name. All of these are things we've seen before. Therefore, though they are worthy of comment, we don't have the liberty to preach on these points. He is your praise. He is your God who has done for you these great and awesome things which your eyes have seen. Your fathers went down to Egypt with 70 persons. And now the Lord your God has made you like the stars of heaven for multitude, proving, of course, God's faithfulness to the promise he made to Abraham. Therefore, chapter 11, you shall love the Lord your God and keep his charge, his statutes, his judgments, and his commandments always. Know today that I do not speak with your children who have not known and who have not seen the chastening of the Lord your God, his greatness and his mighty hand and his outstretched arm, his signs and his acts which he did in the midst of Egypt to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and to all his land. What he did to the army of Egypt, to their horses and to their chariots, how he made the waters of the Red Sea overflow them as they pursued you, and how the Lord has destroyed them to this day. What he did for you in the wilderness until you came to this place, and what he did to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab and the sons of Reuben. This is, of course, a reference to the rebellion, which was actually led by Korah, although Korah is not mentioned by name here. And it's interesting in the story of this rebellion that Dathan and Abiram and their children were all swallowed up by the earth. Korah likewise was, but Korah's children were not. And it may be because his children didn't participate in the rebellion, whereas Dathan and Abiram's did. God sent out laws through Moses that a child would not perish for his father's sins. And whenever you find children, a man's whole family, suffering for his sins, we must conclude that it's because of their complicity in the matter. Later in Joshua, we'll read of Achan and his stealing from Jericho, or from God, really, something from Jericho. And God orders that he and his wife and his children are all stoned to death and burned. Now we say, is that really fair? Well, listen, the thing was hidden in his tent. We have every reason to believe that these people were co-conspirators with him. God would never, as he stated in his own law, destroy children for the sins of their fathers, merely. With the possible exception of infants, whom he, of course, had slain with the Canaanites, but that was probably because the infants would be saved. I mean, it was not an act of judgment against the infants, but just a way of cleaning the land off from all the Canaanite influences entirely, and keeping, making it so that the Jews didn't have to adopt all the babies of the Canaanites, rather swell the ranks of their families, and might be a bit of a burden to them. I mean, all those babies, if they were left alive, would be orphans, and better to send them to heaven, I suppose, than to ask the Israelites, who already had large families of their own, to absorb the large number of children of the Canaanites. Anyway, I think that the destruction of infants, whenever we see it, even David's infant who died, who was the product of the sin of Bathsheba, that was not a judgment on the infant. As I understand, those infants are saved. It's a judgment on the parents. And here, Dathan and Abiram's children, who were swallowed up by the earth with their fathers, must have been accomplices with their fathers, must have been agreed with their fathers, whereas the sons of Korah apparently were not in agreement with their fathers. So Korah died, but his children didn't. And we know that the sons of Korah later went on to become leading singers and musicians among the Levites in the days after David's time and in David's time, and many of the Psalms were written either by or for the sons of Korah. But here there's no mention of Korah. Verse 7, but your eyes have seen every act of the Lord which he did. Verse 8, therefore you shall keep every commandment which I command you today, that you may be strong today, and that you may be strong and go in and possess the land which you cross over to possess, and that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord swore to give your fathers, to them and their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. For the land which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt, from which you have come. For you sowed your seed and watered it by foot as a vegetable garden. Watering by foot refers to the fact that when the Jews were slaves in Egypt, at least those that were involved in the agricultural functions of Egypt, had to pump the water from the Nile with a foot-propelled kind of a pump arrangement. They didn't have real motors in those days, and so any technology they used had to be powered by man or by beast. And so some of them, apparently, to irrigate Egypt, the main water source in Egypt was from the Nile. In fact, the reason that Egypt did not suffer famines anywhere near as severely as the surrounding nations did is because they had the water from the Nile, so that even in times of no rain, they could irrigate with it. But they irrigated using a foot-powered pump. And so what he's saying is, to get any fruit out of Egypt required a lot of effort, the expenditure of a great deal of energy. Not so in Canaan. It's a restful place. You don't have to pump the water. It falls from the sky. It's a well-watered place. He says, the land you're going to, it's not like Egypt, where you had to water by foot as a vegetable garden. But the land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water from the rain of heaven, a land for which the Lord your God cares. The eyes of the Lord your God are always on it from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year. In other words, all year long, it's got favorable conditions for a long growing season and for agricultural production. Now, we could no doubt see an easy spiritual parallel here. In Egypt, represent our old life. Our lives were probably not entirely without the fruit of any goodness. I think even non-Christians do a few nice things. Sometimes show a little compassion. Sometimes are concerned with justice. Mercy is not unheard of among unbelievers, but it goes against nature. Any goodness produced in your life before you were a Christian was done by sheer fleshly effort. Whereas when you're in Canaan, in the new life, you're watered from heaven. It says the fruit is a natural product. The fruit comes easily because the Holy Spirit produces the fruit within. The goodness is something that comes naturally. Egypt did not naturally produce crops. It had to be done against nature. You had to work at it. You had to pump the water from one place to another. In Canaan, however, fruitfulness is natural. The heavens rain upon it. Heaven itself produces the fruit. The work comes from God, from the heavens, rather than from your own flesh and your own effort. And I think that's an apt parallel here. Verse 13, "And it shall be that if you diligently obey the commandments which I command you today, to love the Lord your God, and to serve him with all your heart, with all your soul, then I will give you the rain for your land in its season, and the early rain and the latter rain," which are the two different seasons. The early rain was actually in the fall, and the latter rain in the spring. And the early rain, the two seasons of rain in their growing year, and the early rain would, of course, give enough moisture for the crops to begin growing, and then the crops would ripen later in the spring and early summer through the latter rain that would come. "That you may gather in your grain, your new wine, and your oil, then I will send grass in your fields for your livestock, and you may eat and be filled. Take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them, lest the Lord's anger be aroused against you, and he shut up the heavens, and there be no rain." So there's a threat of drought if they're disobedient. We're going to have to move along here. From verse 18 on, he's a little repetitious of what we ran across in chapter 6. "Teach these things to your children all the time, when you sit in the house and so forth, all the time. Teach these things to your children so that you can prolong your days in the land." In verse 22, he says, "For if you carefully keep all these commandments which I command you, to love the Lord your God," and so forth, same kind of language. Then verse 23, "The Lord will drive out all these nations from before you, and you will dispossess greater and mightier nations than yourselves. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads shall be yours." This exact phrase was used again in Joshua. Speaking to Joshua after Moses' death, Joshua 1:3, God made the same promise. Wherever you put the sole of your foot, God's not just going to bring the Canaanites to you to surrender. You're going to have to move forward. You're going to have to walk. You're going to have to do your part. You're not going to conquer the land just by sitting here and waiting for it to come to you. You're going to have to move forward. But wherever you move, you will have the blessing of God. Wherever you set your foot, God will secure it as your possession for you. "No man shall be able to stand against you. The Lord your God will put the dread of you and the fear of you upon all the land where you tread, just as he has said to you." This, again, is something that is stated to Joshua a little later, that no one will be able to stand before him all the days of his life. "Behold, I set before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today, and the curse if you do not obey the commandments of the Lord your God." Again, curses could come on Israel if you're disobedient. God's blessings on Israel are conditional. You've heard me say it 1,000 times. The reason I say it as many times as I do is because we so often hear other people saying the opposite. And I'm trying to counterbalance that. "But if you turn aside from the way which I command you today to go after other gods which you have not known, then the curse will be upon them." Verse 29, "And it shall be when the Lord your God has brought you into the land which you go to possess, that you shall put the blessings on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal." This is elaborated on later. And in Joshua chapter 8, verses 30 through 35, they actually do this. Half the congregation stands on Mount Gerizim, half on Mount Ebal. These are two mountains within Israel, with a valley between, of course. And the people on Mount Ebal pronounce curses that would come upon them if they do not obey the people on Mount Gerizim pronounce blessings that will come upon them if they do obey. This ritual fulfilled in Joshua chapter 8, verses 30 through 35. Okay, and he describes that. He commands them to do it here in the remainder of this chapter, and they fulfill it in Joshua. Now, chapter 12, we move a little bit now to another kind of thing. We move from the historical survey that he's been giving into some specific laws, and we come to the first instance where he gives a new law that's different for their new circumstances. In chapter 12, it says, "These are the statutes and judgments which you should be careful to observe in the land which the Lord your God of your fathers has given you to possess all the days of you that you live on the earth. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills under every green tree." We find that the Jews very seldom kept this command. Even in days of revival and reformation, most of the better kings of Judah in later history neglected to remove the high places. Although a couple of them, Josiah and I think Hezekiah, also did remove them, but they were later replaced by the apostates in the next generation. "And you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, and burn their wooden images with fire. You shall cut down the carved images of their gods and destroy their names from that place. You shall not worship the Lord your God with such things." Now the concern here is how you worship the Lord. It's not enough to say, we bow down to idols, but we're worshiping Jehovah this way. We're not worshiping other gods. This idol represents Jehovah. This golden calf is Jehovah who brought you out of Egypt. No. You not only have to worship Jehovah, but you have to do it in the way that he prescribes, not the way that the heathen prescribe. Our service to God should not borrow from the heathen. Likewise, a similar statement is made later in the chapter when it says in verse 30, "Take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow after them, after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way, for every abomination to the Lord which he hates, they have done to their gods. For they burn even their sons and their daughters in the fire to their gods. Whatever I command you, be careful to do and observe. You shall not add to it nor take away from it." Now, of course, what we see here again is that it's not enough just to say, I'm worshiping Jehovah. You have to worship him in the way that he said, in the prescribed manner. That's why Nadab and Abihu died. They worshiped Jehovah in the tabernacle, but they used strange fire. They didn't do it the way he said to do it. And I would stress this at this point because of the danger I see in the church to say, well, how do the heathen handle these kinds of problems? These ministry problems. How do the heathen handle people's past problems, their hang-ups, their inner wounds and scars? And they look to the way the heathen do things, much of which, by the way, came directly out of the occult, although it's not very often advertised in the scientific community, but much of certainly Carl Jung's psychological procedures came right out of demon inspiration, as he himself pointed out. He didn't call it a demon, he called it a spirit guide. But his spirit guide inspired him in his views, and his views are among the most popular among Christians today in the area of inner healing. It is for us to be cautious when somebody suggests some form of worship or some form of ministry, to ask ourselves, well, where is that in the Bible? Where did God command this procedure? Where is this methodology modeled for us by Jesus or the apostles or endorsed in the Bible? If we cannot answer that with a specific positive right here, here it is right here in the Bible, then I would say let's stay away from it. And it's not enough for someone to say, oh, but we've seen a great deal of good done through this procedure. We've seen a lot of people helped. That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if a lot of people have been helped. A lot of people have been helped in temporal ways through the occult and through other things that are certainly not godly. If we're looking for temporal help only, if we're looking for healing, if we're looking for prosperity, if we're looking for peace of mind, if we're looking for things that mainly make our lives more pleasant now, sure, the occult offers a great number of procedures that are supposed to help you in that area, and some of them no doubt do. But those are not the things we're to be concerned with. We're to be concerned with eternal matters. And even if we have to be in unpleasant circumstances for this entire life, just to know that we've done the right thing before God is to be our obsession. And therefore, it's not enough to say, well, these occultic practices or these psychological practices, they help people. Well, so does following God help people. But even if it doesn't help them in the ways they want to be helped, see, here's the thing. Can't people be healed through prayer? Of course they can. But what if they pray and they don't get healed? Well, then they go to the Philippines. And they go to a psychic healer over there, and he fixes them. He gives them what they want. Now, the problem here is that God forbids the use of psychics, the use of occult things. If you pray in faith and God doesn't give it to you, you'd be best off resigned to the will of God. But if you're going to insist that you get what you want, sure, the devil's always around to give you what you want. But you're better off with what God wants. A lot of times we want healing and God says, hey, that's not the best thing for you. If it was, I'd give it to you. Got something else for you right now. Paul prayed 3 times that his thorn would be taken from him. God says, no, I got some better idea for you. I give you grace instead. It'll be worth a lot more than a healing.
Amen.
And, James and John came, Jesus said, can we sit at your right hand and your left hand in the kingdom? Jesus said, you don't even know what you're asking for. And I can't guarantee it to you either. But I think a lot of times when Christians are asking for the thing that is most desirable from their carnal point of view, Jesus will say, you don't know what you're asking for. I know better what's good for you. Just leave these matters with me. But when we insist that we get our way, and if God doesn't give us what we're after, what we want, then of course there's always an occultist around who tell us the future when God's being silent. That's what Saul found. God wasn't answering him, so he went to a witch. And she gave him what he wanted to know. Trouble is, he went to hell for it. If getting a healing or getting knowledge of the future is worth that to you, if God is withholding it, and you don't mind going to hell in order to get your healing, then you can go to a psychic. Maybe they'll heal you. Now, I'm not saying God doesn't heal. I know he does. I'm just saying he hasn't always healed everyone as soon as they asked. And in cases like that, I suggest resignation to the will of God rather than insisting that you'll get it by any means possible. And that's where I think philosophically, some of the inner healing teachers are in a different place than what I'm recommending. Because they say, these people have tried prayer. They've read the scriptures. They've had biblical counsel. It didn't help. But this helped. Well, great. That helped. And if the end always justifies the means, then that's fine. The problem is, the Bible does not imply that the end justifies the means. To serve God and to worship God must be done in the manner that He prescribes and not look to Him and say, how'd they do this? I wonder how they can handle these kind of problems. We'll do that too. That's what he tells the Jews not to do. Not to borrow from the heathen their ideas about things like this.
Well, the church is built with so many self-help groups and, things that are supposed to help your self-esteem and just how to, accept that God loves you and all this stuff. And they lack so much faith. I mean, it's going to happen all these people.
God knows. The disciples said, Lord, are there many or few that are saved? And Jesus said, well, strive to enter into the narrow gate, because there will be many who will find the door shut to them, and they'll say, Lord, Lord, remember us? They'll say, I don't remember you. Jesus didn't say there'd be many or few, but the implication was there's going to be many who think they're going to be in who aren't. The number that are going to be in who really, really are in, he doesn't make any statements about. But he does say, when he's asked, they actually asked him, is this the 12th, maybe 12th chapter of Luke? I don't remember the exact place that this is. It's in Luke. They said, are there few people saved? And he said, strive to enter in, because many are going to find that they're not saved. He didn't say how many are going to be saved, which is what they asked, but he just said, make sure you're not in that large number that aren't. That'd leave the judgment to God on that matter. God knows what's going to happen to these people. But I would say, anyone who's playing games, trying to play fast and loose with God, doesn't fear God as much as a healthy, intelligent person, wise person would. God may save them, yet as by fire, who knows? But I wouldn't give them any guarantees. Anyone who's not committed to obedience to Jesus Christ and His words above everything else is not really what the Bible puts forward as the norm for Christianity. They might be saved. They may be a very subnormal Christianity, as no doubt all of us are in some respects. God alone knows at what point, you know, they're no longer, you know, I never knew you. It's going to have to be what he says to them. At any rate, I'm not trying to make judgments about what's going to happen to these people particularly. I'm just saying it is a wrong practice. It is a wrong practice for us to say, well, these are problems that that the Bible and prayer doesn't seem to help. So psychology seems to have gotten an answer from the spirit guide of Carl Jung. Let's try that. You know? No, that's not what you're supposed to do. Now, in addition to that, in chapter 12 here, I'll just summarize. There is a modification of the law that was given in Leviticus 17. In Leviticus 17, verses 1 and following, while the Jews were wandering in the wilderness, they were forbidden to kill any animal for food anywhere except at the tabernacle. And that was because if they were, you know, not accountable when they killed an animal, they might secretly offer part of it to an idol. And that was to assure that all the animals that were killed, even for food, were done under the supervision of the priests, who would make sure that no animals would be sacrificed to idols. Excuse me. Here he gets realistic. You know, these Jews are going to be scattered all over the country. They can't every time they want meat with their meal come down to Jerusalem or to Shiloh and sacrifice it at the tabernacle or at the temple. So he gives them permission in verse 15. You may slaughter and eat meat within your gates, whatever your heart desires. But he does say that they can only sacrifice at the temple. It says in verse 5, but you shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses out of all your tribes to put his name for his habitation. And there you shall go, and there you shall take your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, heave offerings of your hand, your vowed offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstlings of your herds and flocks. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God. That is because eating was part of the whole worship experience of sacrifices. So basically what he says is that whenever you sacrifice in the land of Canaan, you have to do it at the temple. But when it comes to just eating food that's not intended as a sacrifice, you can do that elsewhere. And that's where he gives a little more lenience than was given in Leviticus. And that for logistic reasons, obviously. Everybody in the book of Leviticus was living near each other. The whole encampment was surrounding the tabernacle. But now there are going to be some of them, you know, scores of miles away. And they couldn't make that trip to the temple or tabernacle every time they wanted to have a meal of meat. So he gave them some flexibility. But he does tell them, even then, that they must not eat the blood in verse 16. Only you shall not eat the blood. You should pour that out on the ground like water. A couple of other concerns in this chapter. It says in verse 8, you shall not at all do as we are doing here today, every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes. For as yet you have not come to the rest and the inheritance which the Lord your God is giving you. But what are they going to do? In verse 25 he says, you shall not eat it, and that it may go well with you and your children after you, when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. Now, the contrast there is between doing what is right in your own eyes in verse 8 and doing what is right in the sight of the Lord in verse 25. Up to this point, the Hebrews in the wilderness have not shown themselves to be that obedient. They've rebelled against Moses. They've rebelled against God. They have not done consistently what is right in the sight of the Lord. They've rather done whatever they wanted to do to a certain extent. He says, however, you can't keep living that way. When you go in the land, if you want to keep the land, you're going to have to do what's... You're going to have to be more circumcised. You're going to be more obedient to God. You're going to have to sacrifice what you want to do in favor of what God wants you to do. Now, it's interesting that there is a distinction between that which is right in the sight of the Lord, in verse 25, and that which is right in your own eyes. Because the wrong thing they're doing is not that they're doing what they know to be wrong. But they're doing what they think to be right. But apparently they think it without reference to what God has said about it. Because what God has said is what he thinks is right. But apparently ignoring what he says is right and doing what they think is right. Now you might say, well, we're well-intentioned. We didn't do what we thought was wrong. We did what we thought was right. Well, there's a saying, not in the Bible, that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. There is a saying in the Bible twice in the book of Proverbs, it appears, says there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. You can't go by what you think is right. You have to check with what God said about what's right and wrong. Once again, even with reference to what we were saying a minute ago, about how do we deal with people with problems, what kind of therapies, what kind of ministry do we use for them? It's not enough to do what seems right, or seems to make sense, or seems to get results. That is no doubt what is right in the sight of many people. The question is it right in the sight of the Lord? And the only way you can know that is look at the Scripture, because that's where He has shown what is right in His sight. And to trust the Scriptures rather than our own sentiments, in other words, is what we are here urged to do. Now, rebellion against what we know, what we think is right, is even worse. I mean, if you think something's right and you do what you think is wrong, that's very rebellious. That's even worse. But if you do what you think is right and you're wrong in what you think is right, you're still wrong. And you're not supposed to do what you think is right, but what God thinks is right. That is to say, not what you think is right without reference to what God has said. Obviously, once you've been informed by what God has said, once you've surrendered to God's truth, then what you think is right is more often going to be the same as what is right. But the point is, if you just trust your own instincts about this, if you trust your own conscience about what you think is right, it's not always going to lead you right. Jiminy Cricket said, always let your conscience be your guide, which is not a good advice. You can never ignore your conscience, but you can't always trust it either. The Bible says if your conscience tells you not to do something, don't do it. You can't ignore it. You can't say, I'll do it anyway, even though my conscience won't permit it. Because whatever you do with a bad conscience is sin for you, even if it's not sin for everybody. You can never ignore the protest of your conscience, but at the same time, you can't fully trust your conscience to always be right. You can't trust your conscience that, for example, if you do something, say, I don't feel bad about this, my conscience isn't bothering me about this, that doesn't mean you're okay. Your conscience may be seared. Your conscience may be wrongly educated. Your conscience, you know, may be conditioned by society rather than by the truth. The word conscience simply refers to the moral consciousness or the awareness of right or wrong. Your awareness of right or wrong is innate. You know that there's such a thing as right and wrong, but what you consider to be right and what you consider to be wrong is conditioned by your upbringing, by your moral choices you've made and the things you want to believe and so forth. And so, while your conscience can't always be trusted, you can't ignore it, but you don't just let your conscience be your guide. You let the Holy Spirit and His revealed words in the Bible be your guide. Okay, there is a reference also in this chapter to be careful to give the tithes, that is 10% of everything they have, to the Levites. And he says, that's in verses 16 and following. In verse 19, he says, take heed to yourself that you do not forsake the Levite as long as you live in the land. Because, of course, the Levite needed to live off the gifts of the people. At the end of chapter 12, there is a treatment of things that are vowed. In verses 26 and 27, they have to bring their vows to the Levites also, to the temple. That is things voluntarily vowed to God. Usually animals, or maybe some of their crops. In addition to the 10% that they owed, a person out of gratitude for God or making a deal with God might say, I promise to give you this or that, and once they do it, they have to do that. They can't change their mind after they've made a vow to God, and they have to bring that also to the Levites. That's in verses 26 and 27. In verse 29 it says, when the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in the land, take heed to yourself that you're not ensnared by them. And this is the problem the Israelites had. They had a holy revelation from God, but they had carnal nature. They didn't have a new nature. And that revelation was foreign to them. It was foreign to their nature. God brought it close to them. It wasn't far from them geographically, but it was far from them morally. It was above them. And therefore, there was always the danger in a fallen world that they'd be ensnared by the traps. And that is why they had to simply obliterate the culture of the Canaanites. They couldn't just coexist. Now, Christians are not called upon to obliterate the heathen around them. And the reason for that is Christians have something inside that the Jews didn't have, something to keep us pure even in the midst of a corrupt culture. We can be like strangers and pilgrims in a corrupt world that not only despises God, but even persecutes us for our faith, and we can still remain faithful and true because the Holy Spirit in us has given us a different heart. The Jews didn't have that advantage. They had to simply remove all the temptations. They had to have a nation to themselves, which where none of those tempting things were allowed to even be there, because they simply didn't have the heart to be obedient in the face of temptation. So God's dealing with them was simply to remove all temptations, get rid of all these things, so you don't get ensnared by them. Now chapter 13 talks about what to do about persons who advocate serving other gods. The service of other gods, that is, leaving Jehovah and worshiping other gods, was a spiritual form of adultery. Israel was in a covenant relationship with Jehovah, parallel to that of a wife's covenant relationship to her husband. And such a covenant relationship is exclusive and lifelong. That is to say, it could never be shared with another man. A wife cannot ever have a second husband. And even in the old days, in the Old Testament, when they allowed polygamy, it was sort of a double standard. A man could have several wives, but a woman could only have one husband. She could never have more than one husband. There were logistic reasons for that, of course. The main reason for polygamy was to multiply more children. And one man could have several children by several women the same year, simultaneously, whereas a woman could only have one child at a time, no matter how many husbands she had. Therefore, there was no advantage to a woman having several husbands, whereas if multiple children was all that one was concerned about, there was an advantage of a man having several wives through whom to be fathering children. But when polygamy was permitted, it was still a one-sided deal. A man could have several wives, and a wife could not have several husbands. It was always understood that a woman in covenant relationship with a husband could not share him. I mean, he couldn't share her with other men. She couldn't have her husband plus another man. And in the analogy of God and Israel, it was to be understood that Israel had no option to ever go after another god, ever. It would be comparable to adultery. And adultery was an offense which, when practiced among people, was punishable by death. Likewise, spiritual adultery would be punishable by the death of their nation. If their nation apostatized and went after other gods, it would be the end of their nation. Therefore, anyone they heard running around advocating apostasy should be just put to death. Better that one person die than that the whole nation die. Better that one person be silenced by death rather than let him run free and possibly lead the nation into the doom of the entire nation. And therefore, what is taught in chapter 13 is that anybody who recommends going after other gods should be put to death mercilessly. And there are three distinct portions of this chapter. Chapter 13, verses 1 through 5, describes a false prophet who advocates going after other gods. Then verses 6 through 11 bring up the case, not only a false prophet, but even if your nearest and dearest kin suggest you should kill them, show no mercy. If it's your daughter or your wife or your son, someone whom you love and who's near to you, you shall still show no mercy if they are advocating worship of other gods, which will bring disaster not only on themselves but on all the whole nation. Therefore, better that they die alone than take the whole nation down with them. And then the third instance is in verses 12 through 18, where he gives the example of you just hear a report that someone in some other city is suggesting going after other gods. Well, that whole city, an investigation has been made, and if that city has not put the person to death, then the nation is supposed to rise up against that city and destroy that whole city. Because the fact that that city has not put to death the person who's going around advocating that means that the whole city has already been infected. They're tolerant of this. Therefore, the whole city had to be destroyed. Now, we won't go verse by verse through this because of the limits on our time, but that's basically what chapter 13 does. It's all about how to put an end, a rapid, sudden end, to anybody who might even entertain the notion of worshiping other gods. Unfortunately, the Jews never really were as zealous about this as they should have been. And eventually, not only did people suggest going after other gods, but the whole nation did go after other gods and suffer the consequences for it. But here he suggests, even if it's a seemingly a prophet of God, In verses 1 through 5, he describes a prophet or dreamer of dreams who gives you even a sign or a wonder that comes to pass. I mean, this person appears to be a messenger from God, and yet it says that this message is essentially to draw you away from God, to serve other gods, then you know instantly that those are lying signs and wonders. The devil can also do signs and wonders. This is where the Mormons are make their big mistake. There are certain signs and wonders that the Mormons believe they can point to as validation for their belief system. The only problem is, if they look at their belief system and look at the Bible, they'll see that different gods are there. The God of the Mormons is one of many gods. The God of the Bible is the only God. The God of the Mormons is the father of Satan as well as the father of Jesus. The God of the Bible is not. The God of Mormons is a different God. Now, no matter how many signs and wonders can be pointed to by the Mormons, it gives no justification for believing their system. God himself warns that there might be prophets who come with a false message. They're not prophets of God, but they may appear on the surface through their supernatural efforts and powers to really be. There was a man in Samaria, mentioned in Acts chapter 8, named Simon, who did great signs and wonders, so much so that people said he was the great power of God. That was the name they gave him. This is truly the great power of God, they said about Simon. But Simon was not the power of God. He was a sorcerer. And eventually he himself appeared to repent. His repentance may not have been genuine, but he was certainly not a prophet of God. And so beware. Charismatics, of course, are always in danger of this because charismatics have discovered the power of the Holy Spirit, have discovered the gifts of the Spirit, have discovered signs and wonders, whereas their non-charismatic counterparts have more or less ignored or neglected these things. It is one of the distinctives of the charismatic movement that signs and wonders are affirmed. And unfortunately, it is also distinctive of many charismatics that signs and wonders are there's an infatuation with them. Not only are they affirmed, but they become the thing in the Christian life. You know, more important even than character, as is very clear. Because many people who are healing evangelists or who have signs and wonders ministries have proven to have very poor character. And yet, they're still loved and cherished and kept in the movement. Because they have the mark of the Pentecostal, signs and wonders. Well, this passage warns us, don't be too impressed by that. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, describing the man of sin, it says he will come with great signs and lying wonders, working by the working of the power of Satan. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 10, I think it is, talks about that. So, we are warned here. The main thing to look for is not for the signs and wonders. Those can be found on God's side and on the devil's side. The issue is, what's the message? Is it agreeable? Does it support the truth of God? Does it maintain allegiance to the God that's described in the Bible? Or does it lead to some other concepts of God that are contrary to that of the true God? And as I pointed out, verses 6 through 11 says similar things about if your own son or your daughter, your wife of your bosom, or your friend, your best friend, says, hey, let's go worship other gods. Show no mercy. Your hand should be the first against them to stone them to death. Now, I mean, this seems very severe. But again, it makes it very clear what Jesus said. He that loves father or mother or wife or children more than me is not worthy of me. If you would tolerate a family member suggesting apostasy to you without, in our day, we wouldn't stone them because Christians aren't called to quite that kind of enforcement of righteousness, but we should have the same intolerance, certainly. We should still be just as aghast. We are not called upon to kill these people today, but we should have the same attitude that these people are not to be countenanced for a moment. We should be aghast at their suggestion. And our love for God and loyalty to Him should eclipse the natural bonds of family loyalty and so forth. Likewise, verses 12 through 18, again, if you hear some report about it. Now, he says you got to do a careful search and inquiry in verse 14. You hear that some city or village in your land has somebody advocating or people going after other gods. Verse 14 says, you shall inquire and search out and ask diligently. And if it is indeed true that certain that such an abomination is committed among you, then you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, and so forth. Now notice, you don't go on a rumor. You hear a rumor, then you investigate carefully. Because if the rumor is a false rumor and you smite that city, then you'll be guilty of shedding innocent blood, in which case God will judge you for it. But it's very important. You don't go on gossip. You don't make your condemnation of individuals on a report merely. You have to carefully investigate before you strike. And this is true in all of our human relations, of course, as Christians. If we hear an accusation against another Christian or against anyone, rather than condemning them immediately, we should give them the benefit of the doubt until we have made an inquiry and found out that, in fact, the story is true. We shouldn't even pass it along until we know for certain from good sources it's true. Now, in chapter 14, verses 1 and 2 says, You are the children of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves nor shave the front of your head for the dead. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. He is not here really showing God's concern for the way you wear your hair so much as he's forbidding them to imitate the heathen again. The Canaanite priests apparently had a certain hairstyle, which probably involved the shaving of the forehead on either side of the center to make sort of a little point come down, sort of even like the Satanists cut their hair even today. I mean, not the Satanist priests sometimes do this. It's just sort of a hairstyle that is done in honor of demons, or I don't know what its significance was, but that God says don't imitate them. Don't dress like them. Don't wear your hair like them. Don't do anything like that that is done by the heathen priests. You priests are supposed to be holy to the Lord and not copy those things. Now, in verses 3 through 21, we don't need to even read this. It just goes again over the what animals were fit for food and which were not. That is, which were clean and which were unclean. We had the same teaching, the same list, essentially, in Leviticus 11. There'd be absolutely no reason for us to go over it again. Verses 3 through 21. And then verses 22 through 29, the last part of this chapter, talks about tithing. This is a subject that has come up before. It comes up again and again. Again, there's nothing so much that we need to point out about this, except it talks about an annual tithe, apparently, where it says in verse 22, you shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain and your field produce year by year. But also in verse 20, it talks about at the end of every third year, you should bring out the tithe and of your produce of that year and store it up within your gates. And that'll be for the poor and the Levite and the stranger and so forth. Now, the difference between the yearly tithe and the tithe every third year, I must confess, I don't know. There's just not that much clear teaching in the Bible about it. We just have various passages that talk about tithing. This one raises an interesting question. What is the specialness of the tithe of the third year, mentioned in verse 28? It says that that's put aside for the Levites and for the poor and the stranger. I suppose, since the Levite is one who gets the ordinary tithe every year, that the only distinction between the ordinary yearly tithe and that of the third year is that every third year the tithe will be distributed not only with the Levites but also with the strangers and the poor. Now you might think, well, if the poor only get this once every 3 years, they're not going to eat very well. But of course, there were other provisions made in the law for the poor. They could glean in the fields of the any poor person could walk through the field of a farmer who's been harvesting and glean from it whatever was left behind. They could also, any human being, poor or otherwise, could walk through the field or the vineyard of another person and could eat whatever he could eat while walking through. He could pick and even harvest on a small scale and eat. No one would starve under the law. But I suppose every third year, the tithe would be distributed not only with the Levites but the others, and presumably there might be even more than they could eat, especially since they'd have food from these other sources that the law provided for, and perhaps the poor could even sell some of this or could in some way or another get some financial benefit from it. I don't know. I'm just suggesting what I would guess. It's not all that clear, but it does mention a yearly tithe and then another tithe that is set apart at the end of the third year. Now, I at first wondered, you know, maybe they just stored up the tithe every year And then at the end of the third year, they made a trip and carried all 3 years' tithe at one time, rather than making the trip every year. But that isn't the case, apparently, because verse 28 says, at the end of the third year, you should bring out the tithe of your produce of that year. In other words, not 3 years' worth, but just that year when you brought your tithe, as you brought your tithe every year. The exception here would be on the third year, the tithe would also go toward the stranger and the poor, which it would appear wasn't the case of the other 2 years' tithe. Chapter 15, again, some repetition. In fact, everything in chapter 15 is basically repetition with a few enlargements of not too great consequence. Verses 1 through 6 are talking about canceling of debts on the Sabbath year, every seventh year. Likewise, verses 12 through 18, again talking about the seventh year of service of a slave. He's to be set free. After 6 years of service, he's to be set free. That was discussed in Exodus 21, previously, verses 2 through 6. Verses 7 through 11 talk about the need to have a habit of generosity to the poor in general. In other words, not only the third year when you bring your tithe, but just whenever you see a needy man, you should have habitual generosity. One thing that's interesting, in the first part of the chapter, where it says you shall, you know, release the debts and so forth, he says you only have to do this as long as there are poor people in your land. In verse 4, it says, except when there be no more poor among you. Well, then you can disregard this instruction. You can forget about canceling debts when there aren't any more poor people around you. But in verse 11, it says, for the poor will never cease from the land. So it's clear that the obligation to release the debts every 7 years would be in perpetuity. He predicts that the poor will never cease to exist in the land. Therefore, since this is obligatory, as verse 4 says, until such a time as there are no more poor in the land, it's obviously never going to, there will never come a time when the Jews would not have this obligation. I would point out also that verse 11, for the poor will never cease from the land, sounds very much like what Jesus said in John 12:8. He doesn't quote it exactly, but he may well be alluding to it. When the woman, Mary, poured ointment over his head, and Judas and the others criticized her for this and said, that's a waste of money. This ointment is very valuable. It's worth about a year's wages. It could have been sold and given to the poor. Jesus said, well, you always have the poor with you. And you can give to them whenever you want to. But you're not always going to have me with you, and she's done a good thing. Now, it's kind of a biting remark. Jesus said, you can give to them whenever you want to, because actually Judas was saying he wanted to give it to the poor, but the Bible tells us, John tells us, that he really wanted to embezzle it. And that he was complaining about this expenditure and lavishing of this gift on Jesus because, all the poor, you know, we could have given this to the poor. And Jesus said, you'll have plenty of opportunities to give to the poor, since Judas, you're really interested in doing that, right? Whenever you want to, you'll have a lot of other opportunities to do that. This is your last opportunity to give to me, because I'm leaving. But in saying the poor you will have with you always, in John 12:8, and also in Matthew, parallel, Matthew 26:11, he may be alluding back to this and indicating there will always be opportunities to give to the poor. Although in this case, he's saying that here's an exception, an unusual situation. The opportunity to give to him, who also, he was a poor man as well, as far as his finances were concerned, were limited. He wouldn't always be there to give to, and so for her to give to him on that occasion, even in such a lavish way, was not a waste. There'd be other occasions to give to the poor. Verses 12 through 18, as I said, talks about releasing a bondservant after he served for 6 years. He should be released in the seventh year. This, as I mentioned, was covered in Exodus 21, verses 2 through 6. And then the last verses, from 19 through 23, talk about the firstborn animals are the Lord's. It expands a little bit on the law which we encountered in Exodus 13. Exodus 13 gave an extended treatment of the firstborn and the obligation of giving the firstborn to the Lord, or else if it was an unclean animal or a human, you'd redeem it with another animal that could be sacrificed. Unfortunately, we don't have time to spend on this, but also we don't need to, having covered the basic concepts previously. Chapter 16 runs through, at least through verse 17, the main three feasts Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, which are the rightful occasions for the male Jews to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. These are the principal feasts. There were seven feasts, but the three principal feasts that required the Israelites to go to Jerusalem were Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. God restates this many times. We first encountered these three feasts in Exodus 23, verses 14 through 19. Exodus 23, 14 through 19. They were reiterated in Exodus 34, verses 18 through 23. They were also covered in Leviticus chapter 4. I'm sorry, chapter 23, verses 4 through 22. Leviticus 23, 4 through 22. And again in Numbers, they were talked about. Numbers 28, 16 through 29, 38. Numbers 28, 16 through 29, 38. Now, in other words, twice in Exodus, once in Leviticus, once in Numbers, and now in Deuteronomy, these three feasts are given, and we're told essentially the same things about them. There's no need, having gone through them as many times as we have, to belabor them again now. However, the last verses of chapter 16, 18 through 22, says, "You shall appoint judges and officers in all your gates." The gate of the city is where legal transactions normally took place. "Which the Lord your God gives you according to your tribes, and they shall judge people with just judgment. You shall not pervert justice, you shall not show partiality, nor take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous." That is, a person who otherwise would give a righteous or just sentence, if he is tempted and by a bribe, it twists his words. That is, it gets him to say something different than he ordinarily would have said. "You shall follow what is altogether just, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God has given you. You shall not plant for yourself any tree as a wooden image," as the Canaanites did, "near the altar which you built for yourself for the Lord your God. You shall not set up a sacred pillar which the Lord your God hates." Okay, again, as in so many places, alluding to Canaanite practices which are not to be imitated. Chapter 17, I only want to take this chapter, and that'll be how far I intended to get through in this session. "You shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God a bull or a sheep which has any blemish or defect, for that's an abomination to the Lord your God, for two reasons. One, because a defective animal is not as valuable as a good one. Therefore, a man who gives a defective animal to the Lord is not giving his best. He is just acting out a religious obligation to offer sacrifice, but his heart is not in it. Anyone who loves another party wants to give the best they can to them. To offer God a defective animal is to say, I'm just trying to fulfill a basic obligation to offer sacrifice. I don't really care to give God my best. And it's an abomination to God to just do this out of religious practice. A second reason that it is wrong to offer a defective animal is because the sacrifices were ordained to be a foreshadowing of Christ. And the very flawlessness of the animal was a necessary part of the type. That Jesus was morally flawless. He was without spot or blemish. It says in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 18 and 19. For it says, "Knowing that you are not redeemed with corruptible things, such as silver and gold, from your vain conversation received by tradition from your fathers, but with the blood of Jesus Christ, as of a lamb without spot and without blemish." So there's two good reasons that God required perfect animals to be offered. One, the better the animal, the more an indicator of the devotion of a person offering. And also, of course, the perfection of the animal was necessary to ensure the integrity of the type, that Jesus was perfect morally, unspotted, untainted. "If there is found among you, within any of your gates which the Lord your God gives you, a man or a woman who has been wicked in the sight of the Lord your God in transgressing his covenant, who has gone and served other gods and worshipped them, either the sun or the moon or any of the host of heaven, which I have not commanded, and it should be told you, and you hear of it, then you shall inquire diligently, and if it is indeed true and certain that such an abomination has been committed in Israel, then you shall bring up to your gates that man or that woman who has committed that wicked thing, and shall stone to death that man or woman with stones." Now, that sounds like it belongs to chapter 13. it looks like just another, a fourth example of the same principle. In chapter 13, we saw three examples of this principle. Anyone who suggests or practices idolatry should be gotten rid of as fast as possible by stoning. Now here he adds, however, because the context here has to do with justice. In chapter 16, verse 18 and following, it talks about the need to be just. You want to make sure you don't condemn a person on too slight evidence. You don't want to kill somebody who's not really guilty, just on some accusation that some hostile neighbor may have made against them. So he says, whoever is worthy of death, verse 6, shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses. But he shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness. Here is this principle, which will be stated again in chapter 19 and verse 15. Chapter 19, verse 15 says, one witness shall not rise up against any man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commit. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. That's the principle, usually referring to how a man would be condemned in court. If there's not two witnesses, then his sin is not well established and he can't be punished. In the New Testament, five different times, this principle is restated. Once by Jesus, in Matthew 18, 16. We won't take time to talk about the context, although you may know the context. Matthew 18, 16, Jesus quotes this principle. It also is mentioned by Jesus in John 8, 17. John 8, 17. In a different connection, a different context, a different way of application, too. Paul also uses it in 2 Corinthians 13, 1. He quotes, actually, Deuteronomy 19:15, in 2 Corinthians 13, 1, and again in 1 Timothy 5:19. And the writer of Hebrews alludes to it in Hebrews 10:28. So, these are the... this is a principle that apparently is an important principle in Scripture. It's repeated many times. There are more than two or three witnesses to it. Verse 7. The hands of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hands of all the people, so you shall put away the evil person from among you. You couldn't bring an accusation lightly and hope to not come to the execution. You had to be committed. If you're going to accuse someone, you have to be ready to cast the first stone. In other words, that would ensure that you're not just making light accusations. You have to become the murderer. That is, if it's a false accusation, you become the murderer. You bring innocent blood upon yourself if you're lying. Of course, if you're not lying, you should have no problem being the one to cast the first stone. Verse 8, if a matter arises which is too hard for you to judge, between degrees of blood guiltiness, between one judgment and another, between one punishment or another, matters of controversy within your gates, then you shall arise and go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses, and you should come to the priests, the Levites, and to the judge there in those days, and inquire of them, and they shall pronounce upon you the sentence of judgment. You shall do according to the sentence which they pronounce upon you in that place which the Lord chooses, and you shall be careful to do according to all that they order you, according to the sentence of the law which they instruct you, according to the judgment which they tell you you shall do. And you shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left from the sentence which they pronounce upon you. Now the man who acts presumptuously will not heed the priest who stands to minister there before the Lord your God or the judge. That man shall die. So you shall put away the evil person from Israel, and all the people shall hear and fear and no longer act presumptuously. Now, this appointment of judges, which begins to be mentioned in chapter 16, verse 18, and runs right up through this verse we just read, is a provision for after Moses' death. Remember back in chapter 1, he reminded them that he had appointed judges, and he had also told them, if any matter is too hard for you to just come to me, I'll take care of it, I'll answer the hard cases. But now Moses is going to be gone. They're going to be in a new situation. They're not going to have Moses around anymore. To whom will they appeal? They will appeal to the priests, because the priests were the custodians of the law. The priests were given the duty of teaching the law. They had the copies. Whatever copies existed were in their hands. Therefore, the priests could give authoritative judgments based on the law that was in their possession. The judges at the gates wouldn't necessarily have their own copies of the law. They would have to give judgments according to their general knowledge of God's law, but where things were too specific or too hard for them, the priests would have the actual code in their hands, and they could give a judgment. So the priest would replace Moses here. Now, the important thing to note here is the judges were political officials. The priests were religious officials. Under the period of the judges, the political officials were subject to the decrees of the priests in a theocracy. Israel was not supposed to be an ordinary state. It was supposed to be a theocratic state that is governed by God. Now, every state, every nation had its priesthoods. But the Canaanites and other pagans, the priesthoods were subject to the kings, were subject to the political authorities. But in a theocratic state, the priests who spoke for God had authority over the political authorities. And therefore, the political authorities would ask the priests. And when the priests would give an answer, there was no recourse but to believe and obey the priests. And anyone who didn't obey the priests would be put to death. Now, this includes cases where someone had not really done a crime worthy of death, a capital crime.